Welcome to the Apprenticeship Diaries, where raw meets refined.
Let's be real, we're still working on refining.
What it took, what it takes, and the stories that are made.
Join us as we learn from professionals about how their stories began.
We have an editor, so we can just, you know, edit, you know, our intro. So that way you can just talk, be comfortable, and then we just doop, doop. Intro, outro, edit.
Yeah. But I do want to tell everybody your name. Do you want your last name included, or do you want just first name?
Last name's fine. Yeah, okay. Suzanne
Witt. I know she's a scientist, but I don't know how, like, you know, much you want the world to, like, go on blast.
She's the world's strongest scientist.
The world's strongest scientist, probably.
That's right.
So we're here today with Suzanne Witt, and she's going to talk to us today about probably a lot of things, but, like, mostly... I mean, I'm curious about this because, you know, how you got into weightlifting and all that stuff. And I thought that you and Rico could talk a lot about that.
Yeah.
Swolecast.
Swolecast.
Now let's talk about, how you became a scientist. I want to know how you got into that first.
Okay.
And what kind of scientist you are.
Okay. Sure. So how I became a scientist. First of all, I was raised by two engineers. Both my parents were aerospace engineers, so I had a lot of that influence growing up. Like me and my siblings, you know, all three of us, they drilled like science and math into us. Like these are both really important and you should be good at these things. So just a lot of influence from my parents growing up kind of, I think, molded me as I was going through my education. And so ended up, you know, like science and math was what I was really, I think, better at, you know, just in school and in high school and stuff. So then I went to college, started out pre-med. I thought I was going to be a doctor. But then kind of realized like I didn't really want, I wasn't much of a people person.
I love it.
So, yeah, I was just like, oh, yeah, when you're a doctor, you gotta, you know, handle patients and stuff like that. And mm-hmm. I kind of took some pre-med courses and just realized that I wasn't super interested in it. But I really liked all my chemistry and physics courses. Ended up sticking with that. And... let's see, I did an internship when I was an undergraduate in Air Force Research Labs, and that was really cool. And my mentor there was the one that kind of pushed me to go to graduate school and get my PhD. And so I started looking into that, and for PhD programs for chemistry especially are free. You don't pay for them.
Really?
And in fact, they pay you. Yes, yeah. So they pay you to do your PhD, which includes like your tuition, and also gives you a living stipend. It's very modest. You don't get paid much. But when I heard that, I was just like, oh, well, why wouldn't I do this if like it's free?
Where's the negative?
Yeah.
Why is it that they do that? Do you know, like, why they pay you?
Yeah, so for chemistry especially, there's a couple of different ways that you can get money to be a graduate student. And so number one is through grants. Mm-hmm. So you'll work for a professor at a school and do research for them, and they may have grant money to do specific research. So that's one thing. But the other thing that you can always fall back on is being a teaching assistant or a TA. So I did that for my first 2 or 3 years.
Right on.
Yeah. So when you're a TA, that pays for everything too. So there's a couple of different ways.
Nice. Right on. As you have the periodic table behind you.
I know.
Yes. Yeah. That's right.
I love it.
I feel like it's appropriate Zoom background.
It's
yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
So from there, so you were a TA for a time, which is really cool because I would imagine it taught you two things, like not only what you were learning, but how to communicate that to other people.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yep.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, it was very valuable. But yeah, so then in graduate school, I did TA some, but also you do a lot of research. And so that's where you're becoming more independent and running experiments yourselves and things like that. And then from after graduate school, I've just kind of been bopping around to different jobs after getting my PhD. And so now I am a scientist at a nonprofit research center up here in Michigan.
Right.
That's awesome.
Was there any, like, I'm just curious, was there any, like, huge missteps within that learning environment in the beginning? Like, I mean, I don't know what there could be within, you know, I mean, I would imagine huge missteps could happen within chemistry, but, like, was there anything that, like, you found out in those early times? Like,
did you ever scorch your eyebrows?
Yeah,
off?
Like, never do it again.
I definitely did some embarrassing things in the lab, 100%. I think the worst thing that I did once was I sublimed Teflon.
What's that?
What's that mean?
I don't know what that means.
Played some sublime for the Teflon.
Okay, so Teflon is like, it's a material that they use in, like, coatings for different stuff. Like nonstick pans, I think, have Teflon on them. So it's just this material. But anyway, it's also used in magnetic stir bars. So in chemical reactions, a lot of times you use a magnetic plate, mm-hmm. That you put your beaker or flask or whatever on top, and you put a stir bar in there, mm-hmm. and it's magnetic, so you turn on the magnet and it spins, and so that spins your solution while you're doing the reaction, so it keeps everything well mixed.
Nifty.
And so these things, the stir bars are a piece of metal that are coated in this Teflon material. And one time I was doing a reaction that it had to be at very high temperatures. I knew it had to be at very high temperatures, but I didn't know how high I needed to go. I'd never done it before, so I didn't really know what I was looking for. And I knew that I was supposed to be forming this kind of like white gas.
Uh-huh.
So I knew that. So I kept like cranking up the temperature and nothing was happening. And I was just like, okay, man, you need to go a little hotter. And then eventually I started to see this white vapor coming off. And I was like, okay, I think this is it. But what it happened was, like, when it cooled down, that stuff had just like coated the inside of my glassware. And then I looked at my stir bar at the end of it, and all the Teflon was gone off of it. So I cranked it up so hot that it burned the stir bar.
Wow. Actually.
Yes. Yeah.
That's good to know. That reminds me of the time that I put a grip that I did not realize was made of like a really, really hard rubber into a, at the time I was being janky. So these were like really first days, but you can use a pressure cooker. I wouldn't recommend it as an autoclave, but you can. And I fucking ruined my pressure cooker because the entire thing melted. And I started smelling this noxious fume. And I was like, what the fuck is happening? And I had to wait until it was all done because, you know, it's pressure. I mean, you just got to wait.
Yeah.
And it was just coated the whole inside of the pressure cooker. I was like, oh, okay. So that's interesting.
Yeah,
I guess that can't happen, but it probably was a certain level to which it could have been autoclaved. It's just that with a pressure cooker, you can't control, how much PSI
right.
you're delivering to it. So I probably just melted the fuck out of it.
Yeah.
I put salt in my coffee once.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Chemistry.
Hey, so
it's
like,
hard.
It's
really hard.
I'll bet.
What's the scariest, like, if you had like a mishap in the lab? Like, no explosions?
I've had some fires. I haven't had anything really super dramatic happen.
Well, I mean, a fire is pretty dramatic.
Yeah, I did. I started a fire. I shouldn't say I started. It actually was not my fault. it was my experiment, but it was at my last job, the job at where, so when I lived in Maryland, I worked at NIST, National Institute of Standards and Technology.
Nice.
And when I was there, I was doing a research project where I had to go up to Argonne National Lab, where they have an X-ray light source. And so anyway, I had built this apparatus to put in front of this X-ray beam to do these measurements. And we were, when I was doing the measurements, we were heating this material up to like 850 Celsius. So it was getting really, really hot.
Wow.
And the way we did that was we had these coils wrapped around ceramic tubing. And we applied a current to that coil.
Mm-hmm.
So just a really, really high current. So the coil heats and it gets really hot. So they like glow red because it's so hot. And you put that near the material and that's what heats up the sample.
Right.
But anyway, how the fire started was there was a bad electrical connection in that thing. And so we were looking and like, this is all being done inside this, what's called the hutch. So mm-hmm. it's just like this structure that has a door that locks. So you're on the outside and we have cameras in there looking in so we can see what's going in. And we're like watching the cameras and all of a sudden, like our measurements started looking really funny and we're like, what's going on in there? And then we just see for like smoke, you know, kind of rising like in the camera. And we looked at it for way too long before someone was like, it's on fire.
Like, does anybody see this?
Staring like, at it. Yeah.
How long does it take till it catches on fire?
Smoke. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like, I don't know. Is that smoke? I don't know. And then it's just like, yes, it's literally on fire. So
I would feel
shut
like
everything off, but
every single analysis you have yields something awesome, even if it goes horribly bad. You know?
Yeah, like you learn from something.
Oh yeah, you always
like that's what I mean.
You always learn something, like, whether or not you get good results out of it. That's another.
So, are you like doing different chemistry, like I guess you know, projects every day, or do you work on like one thing for a year to get like a data analysis?
It's a mixture. So at my current job, I have a pretty wide variety of long term and short term projects. So some projects will be like a 5-year.
Oh, wow. Thing.
Yeah. So very, very long term. But then I also have projects that are 6 weeks long.
Nice.
That are, you know, like figure out X, Y, and Z kind of thing. So I work on both really short term and long term projects.
Very cool. Getting back to the initial education, what happened after school? Did you find that school, I guess, where from the TA position, I guess?
Yeah. So I TA'd for my first, I think, 3 years of my PhD program. And then after that, I was just doing research. And then I really didn't know what I wanted to do. So what's interesting about higher education in the sciences, any sort of PhD program, I think, in the U.S., is it kind of prepares you for one career track. And that's, I think that's starting to change because people, I think they're, you know, realizing that you can't prepare like a whole workforce full of PhDs and have them all do the same thing.
Yeah.
So what higher education in the U.S. typically prepares you for is an academic career. So that's right. Like becoming a professor and then, you know, doing the same thing for graduate students like you were.
Yeah.
And that's not what everybody wants to do. That's kind of, it was strange because I didn't know like, I didn't really understand that going into graduate school. I was just kind of like, okay, I'm going to go get my PhD for free. And then, you know, I'll go be a scientist and I'll figure it out. And then when I,
So you're like, I'm going to go be a baller. Stack
of cash. What, how was your parents' insertion during this time? Like, did they have, had things changed a lot since when they, did their schooling?
Well, and my parents, I don't think things have changed a lot. Neither of my parents have a PhD. So my mom has her master's. But my dad didn't go to graduate school at all. So, and they were both engineers. Right. So I think engineering people do get their PhDs in engineering, but I think it's less common than like, physics or chemistry or biology. So a lot of engineers don't necessarily go to graduate school. And oftentimes they, so like someone with an engineering degree and a, bachelor's mm-hmm. can often like out of school make as much as like a PhD in a field like me.
So it is more diversified probably, like as far as like you said, with sciences, it's really kind of tunnel focus on like one thing. Whereas with engineering, it might give you more of a variety of options maybe after your education.
Yeah, I think engineering degrees are more tailored to going into industry positions. Being like an engineer for a company or a federal laboratory, things like that. But going into academia is very, it prepares you for just continuing on in academia, and really like getting your PhD is, people describe it as like becoming the expert in your field.
Yeah.
And that's really what the goal is. And so then the expectation is that you continue to do that for the rest of your life. And, a lot of people, like me don't want to do that. So when I graduated, I felt, very lost. I had literally had no idea what I was going to do. So I took, I spent some time just kind of going around at different jobs, figuring it out.
I would imagine, sorry to cut you off.
No, you're fine.
I would imagine that, cause I think about things like this, like how cool would it be to be the person that creates, the next weird popcorn flavor or something like that. And I don't know if like a chemistry, like, you know, like that would be probably integral in that of like, mm-hmm. you know, testing different flavor notes and things like that. Like, I think,
yeah,
I can see a lot of pathways for what you do, like, you know, mm-hmm. involved in industry too. I just don't know if the industry professionals would really understand how you would apply and how you'd be really heavily utilized.
Yeah. Yeah. And, so flavor chemistry and food chemistry, that's a whole thing. Like, there's companies that are devoted to it. And I think that would be really fun. Honestly.
Well, yeah, you fuck up with a flavor, that could be catastrophic.
Yeah. For us, for sure.
Yeah.
Hey dude, do you work on things like that are classified, or you're allowed to, like, you know, basically share what you're, you know, working on?
I can talk in general terms, but yeah, I mean, like, so most everything I work on, I'm under like a non-disclosure agreement. Just to protect our information. But it's not classified. Like, I'm not in a federal lab or anything like that.
But they don't want nobody stealing your secrets.
Well, yeah. I mean,
it's like KFC and Popeyes, man. Like, you know.
Well, we had talked, and a lot of it comes down to like the actual product is the research, right? Like, so, you know, to disclose, to talk overly about it, I would imagine would tip somebody off about the research you're doing and then compromise the actual product, which would then be your findings. So, being published and things like that and putting out like this is exactly what they're paying for, is that grant, you know, money towards this research study that you're like dedicating yourself to for upwards to 5 years sometimes, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So yeah, I would imagine that's how it is. Less is more. I can kind of talk about it, but
yeah. So it's, yeah. And like, it's competitive and it's, there's a term for it. It's called being scooped. Mm-hmm. So being scooped is if, you know, you've been working on something for some time and like, maybe you, you present some of it and then like someone literally goes back and copies you and does it faster than you or whatever, and then gets it published before you do.
Wow.
Or just by chance, someone else out there is doing something similar and publishes something before you get to it. So, yeah, so you do have to be careful with what you share with other people.
So that's why you started lifting weights, so you could go make house calls like, hey, you stole my shit.
That's right.
That's why Rico would do it.
Dude, I can't believe that people like would poach your shit like that and then steal it.
Yeah, it happens.
Yeah.
Wow.
I don't think it's ever really happened to me, but I know that it does. And I think it's ridiculous because it gets like in my opinion, I think science should be like open. And really, it's like scientific discovery is about sharing information that, with the world, you know, and, it's easier and to make discoveries in, a more collaborative environment, where you have more brains, you know, involved in the process, but then for whatever reason, it's also this very competitive atmosphere.
Well, cause it's about who got the credit, whose name goes down mm-hmm. in history, you know, like, and
yes.
Yeah. And I agree with you. Like, it sucks a little bit that, that's a focus, because I would think that it would slow everything down so much.
Oh yeah. It's definitely stifling, because like in that, you know, area or arena, you'd want to be, everybody's a team. That's how you make breakthroughs better, you know, but if you got people being competitive and shit in that, then it's probably going to hinder a lot of progress.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Damn, I can't believe they're like that. I fucking can't believe it. Everything.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the thing of it is like, I would imagine that it is about a lot of the things that you were talking about. What defines you as an expert? What, you know, from here, it is about your opportunities later, because, you know, how did Neil deGrasse Tyson start, you know, how did he become a celebrity at that point, talking on shows and stuff about, you know, it elevates you to this public eye of expertise, to where people, you know, you can kind of diversify what you do then and what your options are. If you'd want to like go into mm-hmm. more of a talking point kind of thing, like on a podcast, or whatever, then, you know, you have now quantified, you know, your level of experience to a certain point to where you can talk to other people about it and kind of catch them up, which is just as great to me, because although you might not be making groundbreaking discovery, you're catching up the public to what you have always known, which is just as, you know, good in my eyes, because one, it provides options. Like, until today, I didn't know that learning chemistry was something they'd pay you to do, you know? That's something to let somebody know, because it might, you know, it might alter their path too, which is really cool.
Oh yeah.
It's really absolutely neat.
Yeah. I didn't know that about that either until I was, I think, a sophomore or junior in college. Once I learned that, I was like, oh, well, why wouldn't I get my PhD if I don't, you know, I don't go into debt over it. So
heck yeah.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. And it's just going to up, you know, your, prospects, everything. And, you know, groundbreaking stuff has got to be really exciting. Like, I don't know. I would think it would be fun, like going in every day to a lab and seeing like, what are we going to figure out today?
Yeah. No, that is the fun part about it. And it gets, that's what I try to focus on that the most, because it does get hard. I mean, so you, being a scientist is a lot of failure, mostly failure, but every so often, like you find something really cool. And so then it kind of makes it all worth it. And so I try to, you know, in my day to day focus on like really, I'm going to lab and I'm playing.
Mm-hmm.
That's really all I'm doing. It's like being a kid and like being like, okay, if I poke this with a stick, what happens, you know? And that's really I think the best part of it is just keeping that sort of childlike curiosity and,
yeah.
Except for now, the kid can catch the house on fire.
But you got upgraded facilities to work in that kind of is probably, I'm sure, really ready for all those variables. You know, for the most part, they have action plans that are like, oh, if, you know, something happens, we have the tools to put this fire out.
Oh, yeah.
And I like that because I do feel like that, you know, regardless of the fact that you did have a lot of formal education, what you have formal education in is kind of allowing yourself to fail a lot, which is amazing because I do think that in any kind of path, accepting that failure is so, it's so pivotal to realizing that that's when you get the golden nuggets is if you, you know, you kind of take that hit and just keep on going. You know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the way that I look at it is like I have like a very neutral view of the outcome of an experiment. Like, of course I get really excited when something works the way that I think it's going to. But if it doesn't, I just see that as it's just information that tells me something about, you know, how to change things for the next time.
Yeah. Do you think this is a off the cuff question, but do you think that that's, because that's the thing that kind of hem-haws me up with people, I feel, is that I have a little bit more of a neutral view about most things like that because of how much failure I have to kind of welcome and the high level of critique that I hold myself to, that it really hurts me engaging with other people because they have very definite, like, this is good, this is bad, and I'm like, no, it's kind of just, it is. Just kind of is. You're taking it really personally.
right. Yes. No. I have so much experience with that, especially lately. Like, there's a project that I'm working on right now with a collaborator who, you know, there's kind of a lot of pressure to get it to work, I think. And, you know, it's a difficult project, and, you know, every time, you know, we sort of make incremental steps forward, and like, and anytime something doesn't work, you know, certain people are like, oh my God, like we should just quit, you know, like,
and you're like, no,
this experiment didn't work. Like, we should just give up and blah, blah, blah. And I'm just like, you know, it doesn't faze me anymore.
Yeah.
So, but some people it really does. And it's kind of hard to be like, you know, just chill, bro. Like, everything's gonna be fine.
So the projects that you work on, are you working on them individually, or do you have like a team that you guys are?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a team. So my center is pretty cool. So there's a handful of people that have PhDs like me that are like my title is scientist, and so we sort of manage these projects. But then I have a lot of students that work for me. So I have,
by working for you mean they go grab your coffee?
No, I don't make them do that. No. Sometimes I ask them to run to FedEx and ship things, but no. Yeah, they're interns. And so they really do the experiment. So I train them in how to do the experiments, and they run them for me and kind of pull the data together and show me, and, you know, we talk about it, and then I go back and communicate, you know, their results to, you know, whoever else is involved in the project.
So it's happened full circle. Now you're the one that is, you know, explaining everything, which is really cool.
Yes. Yeah.
Your boss hoss now.
Do they teach you anything? Like, is there, like, have you, I find that like when I then had to teach someone my, like my level of testing what I actually knew, like went up, like, and just trying to think about things in a different way, just so that I could communicate them in a different way. Have you found that there's, I don't know, been any, I don't know because I don't know how, it seems like scientific language has to be super concrete so that everybody kind of knows what you're talking about. But is there been anything that, like, I don't know, that you've picked up or learned from teaching?
Yes. Definitely that if, so the way certain things were explained to me aren't always the most effective way for other people to learn them.
Got you.
That's a big thing. Yeah. So, yeah. Right. So, yeah. So I might, when I'm teaching somebody, a technique for the first time, I'll teach them the way that I've been taught, but if they don't get it, you know, then I'm like, okay, I need to figure out another way to explain this so they understand.
Yeah.
Cause not everybody learns the same way.
Yep,
and in doing that, you know, it makes me understand it better.
Yeah.
Every time I have to explain something in a new way, then I understand it.
That's what I've found. It was, funny the other night we had an interview with a tattoo artist and I have no retention for what I buy, like, machine wise. I should. But, like, he's like, oh, you bought a Dan Kuban. Which one did you get? And I'm like, I don't remember. I was like, I know that's horrible to say, but I don't remember. And I was like, man, you really got to start, like, paying attention to what the fuck you buy, Nichols. I know how to use them. I know who the maker is.
Right.
But the individual type of machine, I don't even know what fucking iPhone I have. Like, I know,
right.
I know it's an 8, but I probably would have to look up the exact one. Same with my car. Like, when I was looking up, apparently there's 2 different kinds of Hyundai sedans. And I'm like, why would they do that to me? Yeah. So, but yeah, like, I find that that's something that I get tested in constantly, just even within speaking, is like, you know, you learn what you don't know, and it's like, whoa, I'm gonna have to check my notes about that.
Exactly. Yes.
So yeah. I'm sure it's humbling and awesome all at the same time, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, here's my question. Since we're interviewing the world's strongest scientist, when did you get into weightlifting?
Oh, yeah. So this does have, like, ties into my, professional career, I guess, too. So I was in grad school. So let's see. I was athletic as a kid. I played softball. I was a pretty serious softball player.
Nice.
Who isn't? Everyone who plays softball is serious. Like,
yeah, it's just very.
You're into it, man.
You're like, you're a softball girl.
Y'all do be getting aggressive as shit.
Yeah. I envy your legs. I'm very happy I got to work on your legs, but I have always said,
oh, thank you.
If I were to have any kind of legs out of anyone, it was softball player legs. So they were just the most beautiful, muscular, thick legs that ladies could have. And I was just like, that's what I want. I think that's attainable for me.
Thank you.
Yeah, totally, man. Yeah. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, you're good. Yeah. But yeah, so I started and I was going to play in college. I started going to, you know, practices. And I mean, I was at a Division III school, so nothing crazy. But I ultimately decided I wanted to focus on school. And I kind of regretted that because I didn't really have, like, another activity to replace softball.
Yep.
So I was pretty, like, sedentary for a while. And then when I was getting into graduate school, I was just like, oh, you know, I need to do physical activity. It's important, right? Health, blah, blah, blah. And so I started running. I was like all, you know, cardio, like mm-hmm. that's what you do to be healthy. And I never really liked it. Like, I started doing like 5Ks and things. And
fuck that.
Yeah. I it never really stuck. It was just like, oh, I'd do it for a little bit and then I'd stop. And I'd do it for a little bit and stop. Like, it was never really enjoyable to me. And then when I was, I think in my second year of graduate school, women's powerlifting had been around for quite some time, but, around, like 2012, 2013, I just started seeing it popping up more and more. Like, I think it was growing in popularity. And I started reading articles and like seeing images of like women that were really strong and like weren't afraid to be big and take up space. And I was just like, that's what I want to do. I was like, that is so cool looking to me. And like, I'd never, you know, like with running, it didn't give me this feeling of like, I have to do this, you know, but with powerlifting, it did. And yep. So I found, at my school, there was a powerlifting team that was Dang. Actually ran by a couple of other graduate students at the time.
Nice.
So I reached out to them and they kind of brought me in and showed me some of the basics. And I was just hooked from then. And powerlifted for a few years, but always was interested in strongman, which is like my current focus. Cause like when you're in the powerlifting community, then you're kind of like, it just kind of opened me up to like this, you know, the strength sport community in general. And so I had friends that did strongman and I always, you know, looked at what they were doing and thought it like looked really, really fun. And then eventually decided to sign up for one of those competitions and start training with them and like was completely hooked. And the rest is history. Now I haven't been able to stop. So
did you notice, well, first of all, when you started running and you were like the sedentary life, was there any like, was there anything that pushed you? Cause I'm motivated by pain. And so the thing that started me to get active was like my lower back started hurting. You know, I've always admired people that had physical, prowess and ownership of their bodies, but, you know, were you experiencing anything at that level or at that stage where you're like starting to feel like your body was going to hurt you or give out on you if you didn't do something?
Yes. I definitely didn't feel good. And I think coming out of college, like my diet was really poor. I think that was the most thing was like internally, I didn't feel good. I had digestive issues.
It's all from fucking ramen noodles in college.
Yeah. Yeah. And beer. So,
Beer. Yeah.
I mean, I had a horrible acid reflux. Like, I actually had an ulcer when I was in college.
Oh, damn. Man.
Yeah, and everybody was like, you're really young to have an ulcer. And I'm like, thanks.
They always say like that.
It's the stress of college.
They say that about my knee. You're really young to have a bad knee. I'm like, well, it fucking is what it is. Like, I got to deal with it, man. Like, stop aging me.
Yeah, because we've been trying to train her legs and train around her knee injury.
By trying means that he's trying to get me downstairs finally and do it. Because I haven't done anything, honestly. COVID really knocked me off of a lot of things, you know. I lost my job, so I had to, this might be the first, I don't know if it's the first time you're hearing, but I lost my job at Tattooed Heart, and so I had to go and start another, like, little small place, which is kind of cool at this point, but yeah, like, it was an emotional hit that I have to admit to myself is a lot of ego to have to, like, get over, but you know, I'm moving on from it. Like it is, but I think that the next tier will be me finally, you know, getting back in touch with my body. Cause I can tell like just in the 6 months away, I'm like, what did you do? What did you do? Why are you doing this? But it was so, I think it was just so psychologically needed to like, I don't know, obsess mentally, you know, go through, you know, I talk to myself, like I'll have experiments with like, if I get to talk to that person again, what I'll say. And it just runs on repeat for like months. I'll wake up being like, if you ever see this person again, what are you going to say? And I'll just do it until it's not even a thought anymore. And I'm like, I don't even care. It takes months before I get to like, I think I take a lot of mental energy up, and then it just taps me for the physical side. But it's weird because once you start getting more physical, I do find the clarity and the fat that gets cut mentally happens. Have you found that too? Like since, you're just a lot better at like, knowing how to manage what is and isn't important, you know?
Absolutely. And like when, when I started lifting in graduate school, I think it was absolutely like critical to my mental health because, graduate school, quite frankly, sucked really bad. it's not a fun time, but it was going to the gym was the time that I got to stop thinking about the lab and, you know, trying to finish my PhD and just focus on something that was purely physical. Right. It really like brings you into your own body again.
Right.
So I felt,
Well, it brings you back down to earth because honestly, all your material shit can be stripped away, dude. And the last thing you're going to be left with is your physical strength. Like that's something, you know, that like can never be taken away unless like, you know, an act of God or something happens. You know, like that's yours. That strength is something that's uniquely yours. And like, it just like, I try to get more people to lift, you know, because it does, it helps like, with joint problems. You know, if you have a joint, like a bad knee, you know, strengthening all the other muscles around it will fix that. It might not like, you know, be a like, you know, 100% like rebuild, but it's, you're going to be in a lot less pain. You know, and then on top of that, like you could be having the shittiest, and I know you know what I'm about to say and talk about, but like you could be having the shittiest fucking day ever, get in the gym and you fucking hit a brand new PR, dude. Like it's the feeling. It's like adrenaline. It's like a high on itself.
Mm-hmm. With your ulcer, did it go away once you started getting physical or did you have to do anything for that?
Yes. Well, and also changing my diet.
Yeah.
I think that was kind of like the wake up call when I was like 19 and like had a bleeding ulcer that I was like, okay, something's got to change. Aww. Cleaning up my diet, was a big one. And then, just kind of the realization that I needed more physical activity.
Hey, now how did you find out that you had an ulcer? Did you just like have stomach problems? You're just like, damn, my stomach's constantly fucked up.
I was throwing up blood.
Oh
no.
I would have been freaking out, man. I would have like, I'm dying. I'm fucking dying.
Yeah. And well, it was like that didn't come first. It was just my stomach hurt really bad, like excruciating. Mm. And it felt like anything that I ate was like eating shards of glass. Like I could feel it like just like going down. And it was so weird. I remember the only way I could be comfortable was laying on my stomach. Like that was the only way that the pain went away.
Yeah.
But yeah, other than that, I was just kind of like excruciating pain all the time.
I had a stomach ache the other night and Rico had me lay on my stomach and I fell asleep, you know, doing that. So I don't know what it is. If it just like is kind of a pressure that supports your digestive system. I don't know what that is, but yeah, like I found the same thing, like laying on your stomach for some reason helps.
Hey, and by cleaning up your diet, are you still eating gluten and all that stuff or did you cut out gluten?
So I actually did back then. I cut out gluten. I thought that's what it was. I think like that's when like celiac started, you know, being
a huge
like,
thing.
People. Exactly. But I eat gluten now and no problem. So I don't think that's what it was. I think it was
bread.
More just like the beer and pizza diet.
Yeah.
Now do you drink, pre-workouts or energy drinks or did you cut that stuff out or coffee? Do you still drink coffee?
I do still drink coffee. Yeah.
Do you find a problem with tomatoes? Because I've heard that tomatoes are really highly acidic and like eroding to like your gastrointestinal.
Yeah. I think maybe a little bit, like especially now, you know, it's kind of like chili season.
Yeah.
I
do eat a lot of chili right now, but so I think after some time, like I'll start to get like, you know, some heartburn going and then I'm like, okay, maybe I need to like scale back the acidity.
Yeah. I find that that's it's kind of good. It's confronting, but I feel like it's kind of good to go through those things young because you kind of get a mortality check right away and get brought into better modes of operation like a lot sooner than a lot of your peers. Like, you know, as much as people are saying, "Oh my God, you're too young," I'm just like, yeah, well, I now know things that not people of my age really know. So it's good. Stress, man, stress is like a huge thing. And I'm sure that like you said, your stipend in graduate school wasn't a lot. I'm sure the pressure was high. You probably just had massive stress.
Oh, absolutely.
Were you sleeping enough or were you able to?
No.
Oh, yeah. That probably was a big part of it, too.
Far from it. Yeah. No, sleeping was a problem. It still is a problem sometimes. It's better now. Yeah. I think I'm better at, I mean, my job now is stressful. I think I'm just better at managing it.
Yeah.
Than I was in grad school. But grad school is very, very high pressure. And so it was kind of like, trying to fall asleep at night is just, you lay there and all of a sudden you're just thinking about everything that you have to do or how everything could go wrong and failure and blah, 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 blah.
Like, am I going to blow up the lab tomorrow?
Do you have any, for people that are in graduate school now that you have still a very high pressure job, is there things that you do, you know, obviously weightlifting, we'll talk more about that, but are there things that you do now that you can recommend them to do sooner or like, I don't know, even apps or something like that? I don't know if there's anything that you now do as a part of your life.
Well, I think there's a number of things. So, well, first of all, in grad school, the sleeping thing got so bad that I was put on anti-anxiety meds,
right?
Like just to sleep. I don't take those anymore. And I try at the time when I had the prescription, I tried to not take it as much as possible because they're addictive.
Yeah.
Like the doctor warned me of that, like when he prescribed them. But at the time, I think it was like absolutely essential because it was just like, I just wasn't sleeping. But
yeah.
But now let's see, what do I do? So number one, like, even though I have this high stressful job, I feel like I'm more supported at my job. So I really like my boss. I really like my teammates. So, you know, not to say too much about my graduate school and like call out specific people, but I didn't have people that like I was afraid of,
right?
You know, like how they would react when things went wrong. So that helps a lot. And then the other thing is just I think at some point just realizing the world is not going to stop turning if I mess up something,
right.
If I don't get something done, you know, it's just like just realizing that like there's bigger things than just me.
Yeah.
And exactly. That helps a lot. So just like, cause my type of work, I could literally work on work, you know, all day, every day, because it's just like you do experiments in the lab, but then after that you're thinking about them and like thinking about what your results mean or what you can do next. And like, so that I can do anywhere, anytime.
Right.
And I think a lot of scientists fall into that trap. So just, I guess the realization that thinking about my work all day, every day, isn't the most productive use of my time and can lead to burnout, and that it is 100% okay to like go home at night and binge watch television.
Yeah.
You know, that's,
yeah, junk TV.
Yeah, no. Yeah, unacceptable.
Terrible, terrible things. Yes. to do like, I guess what I'm saying, like, it took me a long time to realize that like doing mindless activities is, you know, not only not harmful, it's also sort of helpful because like that helps me recharge in the evenings and then I go back to work the next day and like my brain is ready to go again.
And I'm sure it helps reinforce the whole idea of play. I did a painting thing with my friend the other day. She's not an artist. She's a nurse, actually. But she's, you know, she's got a good eye. I mean, I saw her do the whole thing was, she was like, let's drink and do, you guide me through a painting and I'll do what you say. Well, and I was like, this is, that's not going to be how this works. Like, cause I don't know how to do that, first of all. And I said, listen, let's start with a thing and then snowball from there. But if any point you want to go rogue and you just want to do your own thing, just do that. And then we did that. And then she was like, I'm hating what I have. And then I was like, well, let's just switch then. And so we switched paintings and then I worked on hers. And then we just kept switching. And then we ended up coming up with two dope paintings that like fit her house. And it really was cool. But like the whole time I was telling her, she was just like, this is awful. This is awful. This sucks so much. And it was amazing to me to see a layman person doing what I do. And I don't give a shit, you know, like I'm like, yeah. Girl, first of all, I'm used to working on people. So I'm like, this is a canvas. I was like, we can go out and burn these fuckers afterwards if we don't get it right. You know, like we can have just an effigy of like paint day and just be like, let it burn. You know? Yeah. And she's just like, this is horrible. I can't believe it. And I was like, you really need to care less. And
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yes. And I've said that to my apprentice too. And it was like a slap in her face. And I felt guilty for saying it almost, but it is a truth, is that like almost when you care too much, you kind of get in the way of progress and you get paralyzed by like this need to have something that you can't even define what it is. It's just like you're unsettled. And I'm just like, you need to let go, like, and just start having fun again.
Yeah. And it reminds me of advice that I heard as a graduate student, like for graduate students, is like, have an activity that you're really bad at.
Yeah.
And just let yourself be bad at it. Mm-hmm. Because it's like you spend your whole day like trying to be this really high achieving person, that it's really can be very therapeutic to just go do something that you're just terrible at. And like in this person that wrote about it, her example was swimming. Like she was just a horrible swimmer. But she went and like did like would go swimming and like basically just like flop around in the water, you know, like trying to.
That's a good one, because that was
better story. Yeah,
just yeah. Floating in water moves your body in such, you know, little ways that it's so good for you anyway. Even if you're just flopping around, like that's such a great one.
Yeah.
Well, that's I like swimming in the ocean, so I can go find shit.
Yeah.
That would be fun.
You might find something you don't want in the ocean, though.
Oh, no, I grew up on the beach. You find shit all the time that you don't want to find, like there's sharks and shit.
Yeah, you're like, I'm not scared. But did you find you were good at weightlifting right away?
No.
Yeah?
No. I think certain things I was good at, just because, like, with, I don't know. I mean, with different, like, body proportions.
Yeah, biomechanics.
Yes, exactly. Like some people are naturally good at deadlifts. Bench pressing, you know, or whatever it is. But for me, I think deadlifts I picked up pretty quickly because I'm built for deadlifting.
Yep.
Like I have very long limbs and a short torso. Definitely not squats. Squats took me years, I think, to get right.
Yeah. I don't like squats.
Well, I think honestly, squats, dude, that's like something that even people that are like, you know, made to do them even have to develop. Cause squats is like, man, that's a fucking, like, really, it's a technical ass movement. You got so much shit going on. Like, you know, deadlifts is like, you know, fucking pick it up.
Yeah. And like deadlifts are like, if something's going horribly wrong, you can just drop the bar.
Yeah. Or brute force it.
Yeah, squats is like, it's on your back.
Yeah.
So if you go down and you're stuck down there, you're like, oh shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
True. I was curious, do you have, because I have a defense mechanism whenever I know I suck at something, I just laugh, kind of like I'll just start laughing when it hurts. And people don't ever know how to act. Like, they're like, are you okay? I'm like, no, I'm actually in a lot of pain and this sucks. And they're like, but you're laughing. And I'm like, yeah, it's a thing.
Not in weightlifting. You're going to get crushed by the fucking bar.
Yeah, but is there something that, like, while you're, like, did you find that you had something that you did as, like, an automatic response after you didn't do something? I don't know. Like, I always...
Like, in the gym?
Yeah, or any... I don't know.
That's if a, I, like... Cry.
Yeah. Cry.
You know, cry. I mean, throw like, things. I've thrown things in the gym before. I'm not proud about that.
Well, when you missed a PR?
Yes, yes. I've thrown things off before. That's why I know. Like, so I've had, like my job with lifting, I've also had to train myself to not take it so seriously. Yeah. Like, it's really important to me. It's something I want to be really good at. But, like, I've also had to learn that, like, sometimes you have bad days. Like, that's how it goes. Like,
oh yeah, lifting, hell yeah.
Days. Yeah. I used to be a very emotional lifter sometimes if things weren't, and it was usually if like other stuff in my life weren't going well either, then it would come down to being like, oh, this one thing that I have that, you know, I can always fall back on as being something that I'm good at is not working too. And right. So that's when I would like break down, cry, throw things.
I love it.
Yeah, I lose my shit. I'm like, God damn it, motherfucker. Yeah.
It's like I'm like yelling at inanimate objects. And like, I've definitely had people in the gym, like, you know, give me like wide-eyed look, like, what is wrong with her?
Hey, but you know what? Next time, like, you miss a PR and you start getting worked up and shit like that, try it again. Because every time I get, like, if I miss the first time and I get so worked up and I start getting real fucking pissed, I'll go back and fucking nail it. Because you get that adrenaline spike. I'm telling you.
I'll try that.
I'm telling you, like, you get that adrenaline spike, man, and it works every time.
I think my laughter just comes to a point of when I was younger, it was a default to that people thought I was crazy, you know? Because, like,
yeah,
it was a bullying thing. It's just like I'd start laughing at my bullies just simply because I knew it wasn't the reaction they wanted, and two, it was kind of a gamble. Like,
yeah.
Is she crazy or I don't know. Uh-huh. I might want to leave this one alone.
yeah.
Hey, so have you stuck thing. To only strongman and powerlifting? Have you tried bodybuilding yet?
No, I haven't tried bodybuilding. I have no desire to. Yeah. I mean, I just don't.
Competitively, just like, you know, the volume and the training, you know, aspect of it. And like even some of the dieting, but not for, cause like I'll do it, but not competitively. Cause I figured out that during the warmer months, I can't fucking eat like I am when the cold weather kicks in and I can't bulk, you know, and put on the mass like, you know, during the summer. So I'll just lean out, improve my quality of muscle and stuff that way. And then I end up being heavier and leaner that summer than what I was last summer. And every year I've been doing it, you know, and I get better and better, and it actually improves my lifts when I do bulk. Cause now I'm hitting massive PRs when the winter time comes, because I guess it took a break. I was able to shed some of the extra body fat off. So it's like, mm-hmm. I felt better. My joints felt better from the break. And then like, you know, you get like that volume in. So your muscles are getting used to something different. And then it's almost like when you make that switch, because like, you know, you and I are naturally, you know, strength based, so we're going to run to powerlifting and strongman. When you do something different and then switch back to what you're doing, it's like way more comfortable. Like, oh, I'm home again.
Yeah. No, I definitely do that. And I think, I suppose I did more kind of bodybuilding style workout like during quarantine when gyms were closed. Because I just, you know, I was working out at home. And for a while, all I had were like bands and just like whatever.
You had great videos.
yeah. I had bands and like I went out and bought some sand, made it like a sandbag to use. What else? I used laundry detergent.
Wow. I bought
laundry detergent. I like tested out different bottles to see which one had like the most comfortable grip for like
doing awesome. Squats.
Dude, and that's stuff. A great idea.
That is a great idea.
So I got creative. And so then I was doing a lot of like high rep stuff. And that was great because when I came back and started, you know, going back to the gym and going a little heavier again, I moved better on everything, which was great.
Yeah.
Like all the high rep and like isolation movements helped, train those movement patterns better. When I went back, it was like, I hadn't skipped a beat, you know, it was like, I didn't forget how to do a back squat or anything like that. In fact, I was moving better on all those things. So
were you going to ask something?
Well, I was going to say, Like, it is good to change it up, and, like, the fact that the lockdown happened probably benefited you, because, like, as lifters, like, you get stuck into bad habits. Like, you'll stay with the same routine, you know, like, you can stay with, like, just doing squat, bench, deadlift and not have any, like, accessories or anything like that. So, being forced to switch probably made you better in the long, you know, in the long run.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would think it would help a lot of maybe smaller isolation muscles, that when you eventually go back to like heavier weights, it probably will help reinforce you a little bit more, just because you're activating probably more. Well, I don't know. Like, a lot of lifts are complicated, like deadlifts and squats, they activate a lot. But like, you know, he's found that he really likes using bands for his triceps. Yeah, and things at the like end, that.
Dude, yo, Suzanne, fucking. Next time you do like your pressing workout, when you're all done with the workout, dude, just take one of those fucking bands and do like a couple sets and just do fucking pull downs with the fucking bands. Yes. Yo, your triceps will blow the fuck up. I mean, like, you can't even extend your arm. Like, it's serious, man. They're like just bloods all up in there.
Yeah. He gets so happy about that.
Dude. Yeah, actually, I did that yesterday. I had a pressing day yesterday.
Hell yeah.
And then it was just sets of pull downs. And, you know, and I try and like just, you know, go slow and like really squeeze at the bottom.
Yep. And then you get that resistance on the way up, which is nice, because I would think, you know, unlike a lot of lifts, well, I mean, lifts, you get it on the way down and the way up. With the bands, though, like on the traditional pull down machines, you don't get as much of that on the way up.
Now you get some slack.
Yeah, you get the slack.
Yeah, that's true.
So it's nice when you do something from like, you know, just using rudimentary tools, I think at home are kind of neat, because I feel like they isolate different muscles and almost might even activate muscles that you would be more likely to use in your everyday.
Yeah,
you know.
Oh, here's a question. When the quarantine happened, did you stay? Because I mean, I'm assuming that you're essential because you're a fucking scientist. So you guys kept on working, right?
Me and a couple of students on this one particular project did. Yeah. So actually, I started my job remotely. So I started working here on March 31st, and it was like a week after they shut down. So I was, honestly, I was worried that I was going to even have a job.
Yeah.
Cause I was just like, you know, it looks like everything's going to shut down. And are they going to just, you know, use this as a reason to be like, hey, you know, we're going to wait to have you start until this is over or whatever. But thankfully they had me start anyway. So I started remotely. And then in being a scientist and working at a research institute, what's cool about that is the sort of the ability to pivot what you're working on. So I eventually got exempted as like an essential worker, and a couple students did too, because we started working on a project related to COVID-19.
Right on.
Yeah. So then I went back, I started back in the lab like mid-May, I think.
Nice.
Right. And so I had been working all summer, yeah.
Right on. Can you talk about your project at all with COVID or no?
Yeah, I can in general terms. I think it's fine. So basically we're developing a sensor for it.
Okay. Right on.
Mm-hmm. So for fast detection.
Right on. That's pretty cool. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
Now, if you're developing something that can detect that faster, shouldn't we be developing things that detect like certain types of cancer faster? You know what I'm saying?
Sure. Yeah.
Like, I mean, I'm not trying to shit on like this COVID thing, but like there are so many worse things. Like, I swear to God, no one's died of old age since March. You know what I'm saying? Like, when was the last heart attack?
Yeah.
You know, like that's my thing, is like there are things way more deadly than COVID ever can be, and like we're not worried about that. Like, there are certain like illnesses that you get and you're fucked like right out the gate. Like pneumonia, you can be a healthy individual, catch pneumonia, and you're gonna be your chance of dying is pretty fucking high.
Yeah, I mean it's a gnarly one. I will say that as far as what it has provided for Suzanne, I'm happy.
Yeah. No, but hey, and like,
no, I think you're right. And I mean, I guess the technology that we're using for the COVID sensor that we're making could be translated to other things that you're interested in detecting.
That's cool.
So I know, I mean, so I think for this project, like, you know, we're going to finish up the sensor for COVID, but I don't think like sensors in general will go away for us after that.
Yeah, no.
I'm imagining this will branch off into other things.
Tip of the iceberg.
So within that, then, are you around a lot of like, you know, controlled spaces where you are actually encountering the disease itself? Because I would imagine you'd have to have it available to then have a thing that registers it.
Yes. So not really. So the way that you get around that is like, we're still kind of in the early stages of developing this thing. And what you can use for experiments is just a portion of the virus.
Okay.
So there's like, you can actually buy pieces of it, you know, different proteins that are on it. So like, you know how it looks like a ball with these spikes?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we work with just the spike.
Okay. Right on. That's
like,
cool.
Looks like the dog toy that you buy from, you know, Pet Value or Petco.
Yeah.
It really does.
I will say this. Yeah. I'm going to shout it out just slightly because I thought it was brilliant. We have a friend, Jake Nodar or Noder. I don't know how
Nodar.
Nodar. He's fantastic, but he has a really good thing on IG about how he knows how to make a Halloween costume, a COVID Halloween costume. So if you ever want to check that out and get a good laugh, definitely.
Okay.
It's really cute. And I was like, oh, that's a good idea.
Hey, and I mean, like, you being a scientist, like, this is what I assume, like, you know, some of you guys got closed down, it's crazy because doesn't it have to be a constantly sanitary environment and you always have to wear a mask because you're a chemist, you know, a scientist, and you're probably dealing with shit that could probably knock you out fume-wise, you know? So aren't you always having a mask, goggles, the gloves, and I know you got the lab coat?
Yeah, basically those things. So, like, yeah, so in the lab, what you wear, I think, depends on what you're working on. So like what I do with the sensor stuff there's not a lot of safety risk involved with it. So we have to wear masks at work just because of the pandemic, but, masks, glasses, always gloves, lab coat usually. But then I have another project. So we have other projects dealing with water treatment, and we work with really nasty water samples, like stuff that's like, I opened this one container and I was like, oh, shut it. Yeah. Shut it.
Oh, that was so probably bad. The Chesapeake water.
Honestly, that's one of the worst smells I've ever had. Like the hair traps in my dad's hair salon.
Oh,
like when
God.
Hair oh. and what? Oh man. Oh man.
It's
bad.
For that, we wear like a full respirator.
Yeah. I would imagine.
And then you can't smell anything.
That's great.
Nice. Like, aside from the, you know, the COVID project, do you have anything else that you're working on that excites you, that you're looking forward to finding out, you know, what the end result is?
Yeah, absolutely. So, the COVID project was not something that, you know, I ever expected to work on.
Yeah.
But what they hired me to work on mostly was these water treatment projects. And so I don't know if you've heard of PFAS. It's common. It's sort of like a regional problem in Michigan. It's a big problem, but PFAS stands for per and polyfluorinated alkyl substances.
Okay.
And so these are these chemicals that are found in a lot of industrial processes and products. So like they're used in nonstick pans, they're used in firefighting foams, flame retardant materials, like all kinds of stuff.
Right.
And the why people like them for these different products is they're really, really stable.
Right.
But then the problem with that is once they get into water streams, they don't break down.
Gotcha.
So they call them forever chemicals.
Oh.
Because they get into the water and then they just sit there. And that's the problem, because if you ingest them, that it can, it has like, there's a variety of health effects that it can lead to, like cancer being the number one.
Right.
Anyhow, so what happens is that they, it can get into the water, and there's ways to remove it from water, but there aren't really good ways to destroy it. So what happens is they use these different technologies to remove PFAS from water, but then they just take that and dump it in a landfill.
Yeah, I would imagine it just recommits it.
Yes, it just keeps coming back into the water stream.
Well, now we know that shit can be burned. is a better way that you're finding. I mean, I don't want to, you know, get too far into your research, but it would imagine to me much like you know, they have different disposal facilities for everything. You know, there's certain things that you burn because that's the way you deal with disposal and things like that. Mm-hmm. It seems to me like it's leaning towards like light the bitch on fire kind of thing.
Yeah. So yeah, there's really like two main ways of dealing with it. And that's mm-hmm. one is to basically store it forever okay. in tanks, you know, and then the other way is burning, incineration.
Can it be recycled? Hmm? Can it be recycled? If it's a forever compound, could it go towards making or, like, can it be, you know, because, okay, so you're saying a flame retardant thing or then a nonstick thing, then it's this forever chemical. Could it be recycled or no?
I think possibly.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there's people that are working on that.
Yeah.
The one, so in general, we're pretty bad at recycling.
I know.
So it's like, yeah. So it's like, so, I mean, it's something like, I don't know, I haven't looked at the statistics in a while, but it's like 2% of the material that people actually put into recycling actually gets recycled.
Yeah. No.
Yep. That's right.
We know that too. Like,
it's a joke.
It would be nice if that was not a good, you know, the statistic have, but yeah, like the landfills and everything has been our kind of default for disposal.
Yeah. Regardless. Just dump it. Yeah.
Well, and their, you know, methods to help clean shit up are stupid. Cause you know, like my family owns restaurants. Well, you have to switch to the paper cups, right? You don't have to do it till the end of the year. But this is how fucking stupid that these people are. They want you to use a paper cup with the fucking plastic straw. I'm like, yo, the styrofoam cup wasn't the problem. The fucking straw is, because they're finding the damn straws in turtles' noses. It's like, how about just make everybody drink out of the cup like a person? Like, you don't even need a fucking straw. Or make those lids, like, you know how you got the coffee lid that has the little tab that folds back?
Uh-huh.
Make every lid that way. Like, that's how the future of drinking things should be, because there's no, the styrofoam cup is not the problem. Like, you can burn that shit, but the plastic straws are the ones that are making their ways down drains and shit like that. And then they end up in the ocean. And then, like, I've seen the videos where they caught a turtle and this straw is like impaired. And like, if they didn't get to it within the day, it would have died, but they saved this turtle's life and they pulled this fucking long ass straw out of its nose. Well, and I'm just like, the paper cup's not the problem.
And now they got the metal straws that can equally happen too.
Yeah. It's like, just make the fucking lids with the pull tab.
I don't know why we need straws.
We don't.
I
don't know why.
I can see why. Like, so if you're an older person that has Parkinson's, it would be a lot easier to leave your cup stable and then, you know, like,
no, that's
try
not,
to get your straw and then sip than it would be to try to hold a cup and, you know, I don't know. If you're an older person, if you're a younger person, I think anything with like a sippy, I don't know why it doesn't have like a sippy quality anyway, because every time you take a swig of a cup, there's always some dribble that either goes down the side of the cup or on your face. So, like, mm-hmm. I think that's the other thing that it's trying to, you know, get rid of, is just this little drop that always trickles down the side of the cup that ultimately leaves the ring around the cup at the end, where it's like it's sitting on the surface and you're like, oh shit, now I got rings all over my damn table.
No, that's trust my, me.
I don't know. They, it's push, like one problem that snowballs into
they
the want, next.
They like, you know, the straws have nothing to do with any of that. The straws are basically, the second that they found out that you actually drink more when you drink out of a straw, they're like, oh shit, we can sell more shit. That's exactly where that idea comes from, because when you drink like out of a regular cup like this, you don't drink as much. But when you drink out of a straw, you drink like two times the amount than you normally would.
Well, and it's probably an ideal way for your body to take in liquid in mass quantities, I guess. It like allows your esophagus to have like, you know, I don't know.
No, it's probably better to drink the human way, straight out the fucking cup. The real human way is the...
Yeah, cupping, you know, in your hand.
Hey, and everybody's done this at 3:30 in the morning when you wake out of a dead sleep, dehydrated. You're sitting at the faucet like... with your two hands together trying to drink. I know you've done that, Suzanne.
Or you pre-think it. Of course. Pre-think it and leave a cup by the sink. But yeah, that's cool. I'm excited for your findings there. That's really neat.
Well, now since we got to the most exciting, what's the least exciting project that you're working on? Thanks for listening. You can find the Apprenticeship Diaries on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Our IG is the_apprenticeship_diaries. If you would like to offer constructive criticism or an interview, drop us an email at theapprenticeshipdiaries@gmail.com. We look forward to hearing from our listeners.